It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 876 for the 5th of April, 2024. This week, the virtual desktops feature that was added to Windows 10 and improved in Windows 11 can help organize the computer when you need to work on more than one task at a time. In short circuits, artificial intelligence is now being used to improve audio recordings by removing flaws such as background noise and room echo. Despite being new, the results are already astonishingly good. Bugs are a simple fact of life for computer users. If you're delaying a purchase until all of the bugs have been eliminated, you're gonna wait for a very long time. Windows 10 added a feature that macOS and Linux users had used for several years, virtual desktops. Those of us who have multiple monitors may not find this option to be compelling, but it's worth taking a look anyway. Technically, this isn't a new feature for Windows. Microsoft actually introduced the Virtual Desktop Manager for Windows XP. That's the operating system released in 2001. It didn't work very well, and support was not included when Vista arrived. Then open-source apps such as VirtualWin and Visual Dimension were released to fill the gap. But the feature became a built-in function with Windows 10, and additional capabilities have been added in Windows 11. If you regularly need to move Windows around on the computer's desktop, virtual desktops could become your new best friend. The implementation varies a little bit between Windows 10 and Windows 11. Any illustrations you see on the TechBiter Worldwide website will be for Windows 11. Accessing the Virtual Desktop Manager is similar to starting Task View with the Alt-Tab keystroke. That's been a part of Windows for years, but it uses either the Windows key and Tab or the Virtual Desktop button if you haven't removed it from the taskbar. The virtual desktop view shows applications that are active on each screen, and just above the taskbar, selectors for whatever virtual screens you've defined. After creating a new virtual desktop, you can drag apps from one screen to another. For testing, I placed my email client, Thunderbird, and Beeper, a chat application, on one virtual desktop, and left all of the other applications on their original desktop. This is a point where some people get bogged down. It may appear that the only way to switch between virtual desktops would involve pressing the Windows key and Tab, and then using the mouse to select another desktop. That would be clumsy, but that's also not the case. Pressing the Windows key, Control, and the left or right arrow pops instantly between desktops and without having to remove your hands from the keyboard. As is typical for Microsoft, other ways exist. If you're using a touch-enabled device and you have the appropriate option turned on, swiping left or right with either three or four fingers will switch desktops, and you get to choose whether you want to use three fingers or four. Windows key plus Tab opens the task view where the arrow keys cycle through apps open on the current desktop, or use the mouse to click the task view icon and then choose the desired desktop. Find the way that works best for you. It is possible to open some applications on multiple desktops simultaneously. Windows 365 apps, for example. You might have a business document open in Word and a web browser open with a business document on one desktop, and another instance of the browser and another instance of Word with a personal document on another desktop. This doesn't work with an application that can have only one instance open. Thunderbird, for example. If the email application is open on Desktop 2 while you're working on Desktop 1, and you click the Thunderbird icon in the taskbar, the computer will switch to Desktop 2. But there's a quick, easy workaround for that. To resolve the issue, right-click the application and choose Show This Window on All Desktops. Problem solved. It's easy to make virtual desktops and then delete them when you no longer need them. If you don't delete a desktop, it will be retained even after you reboot the computer. But applications assigned to the various desktops do not persist. That would be a really good feature for someone to develop, because even though virtual desktops are easy to create, having to assign your preferred applications to each desktop at boot time might waste as much time as the virtual desktop option saves. So I'm not recommending against using virtual desktops, but I wonder if the extra setup time is a good investment every day. Perhaps the best use of virtual desktops might be for those instances in which you find yourself switching between two or more projects that require substantially different applications. In other words, set them up on an ad hoc basis. Multiple virtual desktops on multiple physical monitors might be the best possible arrangement. In that case, you'll want to know one more shortcut option. When you want to move a window from one screen to another, you can grab the title bar with the mouse and drag it to the other monitor, or you can do it the easy way. With the app selected, press the Windows key, Shift, and the left or right arrow, and you'll move the app from one screen to the next. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, artificial intelligence is working its way into many everyday functions. We can remove unwanted objects from photos while they are still on our phones. Photoshop can adjust images to fit spaces by adding realistic content. Microsoft applications can read and summarize reports. And now Adobe is using artificial intelligence to improve audio recordings. At the time I prepared this report, Adobe Podcast was available only to a limited number of users. Early beta testers can use the service for free. It is unclear when it will be generally available, whether it will be included in Creative Cloud or maybe as an extra cost add-on feature. We also don't know what the cost will be, if there is one. It was pre-launched as a free service for early access users who requested access in 2023, and it looks like some basic functions may continue to be free whether you subscribe or not. This is an application that could bring massive changes to podcasting, if for no other reason than its ability to clean noisy audio, eliminating background noise and clutter. Adobe Podcast uses AI to remove background noise and improve audio clarity, to create a transcript that can be used for editing, and allow remote recording via the internet. A mic check feature lets even those who have no experience with audio optimize their recording setup, and the service integrates with popular hosting platforms to simplify the entire process of recording and publishing podcasts. Adobe Audition has a noise reduction function, but comparing that function to Adobe Podcast would be unfair because the noise reduction function in Audition takes a single noise sample and applies it uniformly across a section of a recording. It works just fine if there's continuous, unchanging background sound, a fan, for example, but it is less effective in dealing with more complex scenarios with different kinds of noise. So if you want to give it a try, start on the Adobe Podcast website. There's a link from the TechBiter Worldwide website. You can request access right there. If you're accepted, you'll be able to use the system and send feedback to Adobe after using it. Presumably, anyone will be able to sign up when it's generally available. As noted, though, timing and cost are not yet available. Users can record online or make recordings with some other application or portable device and then upload the recordings. One clear clue is present in the recording application that enhancing speech is just the beginning, though. There's a filter button that opens a tall selector window. That tall selector window currently has just a single feature, so it seems likely that more filters will join enhance speech in the near future. Let's hear what Adobe Podcast can actually do. TechBiter Worldwide is recorded in a room that was never intended to be a studio, but I place the microphone close and I have some sound conditioning acoustic foam in place. I made a test recording with the microphone about 3 feet away. That's really way too far. And this was the result.
This is a test. Normally, I use the microphone very close, but in this case, it's about 3 feet away and in a room that's relatively quiet, but not entirely silent.
Then I use the application's Enhance Speech filter.
This is a test. Normally, I use the microphone very close, but in this case, it's about 3 feet away and in a room that's relatively quiet, but not entirely silent.
Impressive. The noise is gone, but the hard limiter seems to be a little too aggressive. Still, the resulting audio is far better than the original. Perhaps the most remarkable feature Adobe Podcast offers is the ability to edit audio without ever seeing a waveform. I've worked with audio editors for a long time, and I have enough experience that I could do some editing without even being able to hear the audio. The user can now edit using the transcript that the application creates. The transcript, not a waveform. I recorded a brief section with audio to eliminate, but there were also a couple of awkward pauses and an error. Here's what I started with.
Here is another test. This will include a section that I would like to remove. I would like to remove this section right here. And then the text, or actually the voice, continues like this.
I needed only to select the words that I wanted to eliminate, the pauses I wanted to close up, and the error. Clicking the trash can eliminated them. And again, I did this without even seeing a waveform.
Here is another test. This will include a section that I would like to remove. And then the voice continues like this.
Okay, the edits aren't perfect. Had I done the editing manually with an editor that shows a waveform, the result would have been better. But here's what's remarkable. Someone who has never edited an audio file before would be able to perform editing like this because it looks so much like a word processor. Music can be added too, but currently there's no way to put music under speech. If you drop an audio track in, the audio plays and then the speech track plays. That's possibly a feature that'll be added before too long. In addition to being able to record audio online, users can upload files. Before recording a podcast, check your microphone setup. When I made the noisy recordings that you heard earlier, I was about 3 feet from the microphone. As a result, room noise and echo were apparent, although within more or less an acceptable range. When I moved closer to the microphone, both background noise and echo were significantly reduced, so the optimization process would have less to do. The distance between the person speaking and the microphone has a significant effect on the recording. Give a listen. Here's an example that shows the importance of the distance from the microphone. Here I'm too far away. Here I'm at a closer position, and this is probably what most people would use normally. And then there's the really up-close position that a lot of disc jockeys like because it creates what's called a proximity effect. Anyone who produces podcasts today can look forward to spending less time performing tedious cleanup work as Adobe expands, enhances, and refines what's currently being called Adobe Podcast. For more information and to sign up for a test account, visit the Adobe website. There's a link on the TechBiter Worldwide website, www.techbiter.com. Do bugs bug you? Software bugs, firmware bugs, hardware bugs? Why can't project managers, developers, and quality assurance teams get it right the first time? Well, anybody who expresses that opinion clearly doesn't know much about hardware, firmware, software, or life. Errors are very much a part of who we are. How flawless is your driving? Have you ever turned right when you should have turned left? Have you ever sent an email that contained a misspelled word? Or have you ever sent an email without the attachment you promised? Has the IRS ever caught a mistake in one of your tax returns? Well, as for me, guilty on all counts. Any computer programming I've done has been relatively simple stuff. JavaScript or PHP for websites, the occasional Perl script, BASIC in the good old days, and Python now. But there's probably not been a single instance in which even a relatively simple program worked exactly as I expected it to on the first go. Software developers joke about saying, it didn't work. Why? Then they fiddle around, change some apparently inconsequential bit of code, and the program works. And then they say, it worked! Why? Sometimes it's considered progress even to get a different error message when something fails. And even when a program compiles and runs without apparent error, it's not perfect. Any software developer who waits for perfection will never release any product. TechBiter Worldwide has maybe 500 to 1,000 lines of code every week. Most of it's HTML, but there is some CSS code, some PHP code, a little bit of JavaScript. There are errors in the code. I know that. In some cases, the errors are present because I haven't found them yet, because I do generally fix errors when I find them. But there are a few that I simply haven't bothered to fix because they don't cause any problems. I know they are present, but fixing them would be more trouble than it's worth. Microsoft says Windows has about 50 million lines of code. Some sources say Google's code base is in the range of 2 billion lines of code. So there are certainly errors in there somewhere. There's no way to eliminate them all, because fixing one error sometimes causes another error, or makes a previously invisible error visible. Now, this is not to pointlessly defend Microsoft, a company that has made no small number of errors and bad decisions. But Windows developers face enormous challenges. Anybody can build a computer intended to run Windows. The builder can use parts of questionable quality, and they can mix hardware components that really aren't intended to be used together. Users can poke around inside the registry. Drivers written to operate hardware devices can have bugs that Microsoft can't control. There is simply no way for Microsoft to test every possible combination of hardware, firmware, software, drivers, and user modifications. There will be errors. There will be crashes. So if you're waiting for perfection, you will have a very long wait. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.